Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Norman Mailer. His most recent book is The Gospel According to the Sun. It's from Random House. I have to say, I only stand, it seems, in a special relationship to the books of Norman Mailer. I'll read a series of reviews and then say, what are they talking about? They're not reviewing this book. They're reviewing what they expect Norman Mailer to do next. This is The Gospel According to the Sun. It is an arranging of the New Testament in chronological order from the point of view of Jesus as the events basically occur in his life. And so we're reading, in essence, for the first time, the story told directly by the Son. And it seems to me that it stands in a very admirable literary tradition. At a certain point, Thomas Mann, living in America, saw it fit to write volume after volume of the lives of Joseph and his brothers, that turning to the biblical stories is often a test for the writer. He's developed his skills. It's now time to turn them on prepared material to see how the writer hones his voice against an eternal text. Am I right? Is this the...
No, I was listening wistfully. I wish I could have put it that well myself.
but this is, it seems to me, an act of piety. And I think that you are a very, you know, paradoxical figure in that everyone would expect, and the reviews that I've read seem to have expected, that Norman Mailer, writing A Life of the Sun, was going to set it on a street corner in Flatbush, that there would be some kind of aggression, or, on the other hand, that he would tower over the text. But the point here seems to be that this book is a relaxation of hubris. It wants to be as simple and wants to obey the literary precepts of humility that Jesus would seem to preach, yes?
I wouldn't argue with that, but I wouldn't call it pious. I don't like piety. I really don't. One of the bonds I felt with Jesus is he did not like piety. My idea of a great man is that they don't like piety, because piety is a cruel crutch for people who don't quite need that much piety, and it tends to arrest development. So I would not like to think of my book as pious. I would like to think of it as walking that tightrope between between piety and satire. Because between the two, if you do it carefully enough, you get a kind of life that you can only get in a book.
I wanted the listener to hear the version of the raising of Lazarus so that people can hear how closely Mailer reaches this tone between satire and piety. And this is...
Avoids satire, avoids piety.
Yes, but between...
Yeah,
yes.
You'll have to walk between them. Yeah.
Yeah. So shall we hear Lazarus?
Sure. No, I'll be happy to read it.
Norman Mailer reading The Gospel According to the Sun, The Raising of Lazarus, published by Random House.
Let me give the background to it before I start reading it. In the version that I write, Jesus approaches Jerusalem with much trepidation. He's been having dreams that while he is in Jerusalem, he is going to be arrested and crucified and will die and then will rise 3 days later. And he tells this to his disciples who don't wish to believe it, who refuse to believe it, or are terribly depressed by it. They all leave with varying difficulties. It takes them quite some time to get everything together and to leave Galilee to march down to Jerusalem, which is normally a two-day march. And when they finally get going, they're on their route when the following happens. It's on the second morning. Next morning, as we set out, two sisters of my follower Lazarus came to meet us. I had dined with Lazarus in Capernaum, and he was a good man. Now his two sisters, Mary and Martha, had walked from his house in Bethany to find me. And they said, Lord, Lazarus is sick, our Lazarus. And by the way it was said, I knew that he had a sickness unto death. They wept. As if I were brother to his illness, my fever came back. My night of rest was lost. I had to stay two nights more in Zacchaeus's house, and we were still a full day's march from Jerusalem. When I awoke on the fifth morning of our departure from Galilee, I was well in body, but otherwise full of woe. And I said, Lazarus is dead. The apostle Thomas was simple, and often uttered what others thought. Now, he said aloud, let us go to Jerusalem so we can die with him. There was much displeasure at Thomas's remark. We walked all that day and into the evening before we came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived in a house an hour's walk from the walls of Jerusalem. And I could see many Jews on their way to his home. Indeed, his sister Martha came to meet me and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. I was ready to agree. Nonetheless, I said, your brother shall rise again. Then came Mary, the other sister, and she sat at my feet and was followed by others also weeping. And when they looked at me, I said, where have you laid him? Lord, come and see. How could I know whether God would grant me the power to return him to his sisters? Lazarus had been dead for 2 days. Many Jews around me, friends of the dead man, seeing me in anguish, said, behold, how he loved Lazarus. They led me to a cave with a stone across the entrance. I said, take away the stone. But Martha said, Lord, who can speak now for his body? Yet at my sign they removed the rock from the entrance. I lifted my eyes and cried out, and my voice roared in my throat, Father, let Lazarus come forth. Then I was silent. When the spirit left a man, all that was unclean in his spirit was loosed as well. So I waited for the odor to enter my nose. Indeed, I asked myself, how can one raise a dead man from his tomb when all the evil of his past holds him down? The Lord must have heard me. I saw the face of Lazarus. I saw him stir. Again I cried, Lazarus, come forth. And I heard him answer, oh, Yeshua, said Lazarus, small creatures speak to me and they say, you are not our master, Lazarus, but our wiping cloth. Thus speak the maggots. I prayed for his misery to cease. And it was then that Lazarus rose in his tomb. I saw him come out of the mouth of the cave and take small steps toward me. These steps were small because he was bound in his winding sheet. His face was also covered. I said to his sisters, loosen him, but do not look at him. Then, in the voice of a man who has dwelt in lands that others have not entered, Lazarus said, the maggots have left me. His voice was like the small cry of a bird, yet he was alive.
Norman Mailer, reading from the Gospel according to the Son. Now, let's begin. This is the real subject matter. In adapting this story, what are your concerns?
Can you play with the word concerns just a little? Because I have large, whenever I'm writing, I have large concerns, small concerns, contrary concerns. I want to be literary. I want to be readable. I want to be wonderful. I want to be honest to the material. So I'm not certain.
Is there something that you want the reader to see in your version of the Lazarus story that he would not have seen in the New Testament, in the King James version of the New Testament, say?
I wanted the reader to have a better sense of what it's like to raise a man from the dead. That is, he will stink. He has lived with maggots. it's not a clean or enlightening process. It's part of the very guts of what Jesus was doing. He was healing lepers. He was dealing with a great many unpleasant human conditions. His hands were dirty, not morally dirty. They were dirty with the work of what he was doing. And I wanted that to come across, because that to me was part of the humanity. You have to understand that my feeling was not that I want to write a pious work. I'm not interested in bringing people to Jesus. What I'd rather have, you know, one of my favorite remarks is, we'll have a good society when the criminals get better and the police get better. In other words, it's not for us to decide. And it's one of the reasons I loathe political correctness. It's not for us to decide what is proper human behavior. All we can ask of ourselves is that we all get better in what we see as our way. And so one of my major fundamental head-on concerns was I wanted the story to come alive for people who live in a vast no-man's land where they pay no attention to the story, because this is the story we're dealing with. The people who rule our lives, for the most part, are Christians, or they're people, often Jews, who certainly don't argue with Christians. The Judeo-Christian philosophy rules America, together with its huge paradoxes, because it's also the corporation rules America much more than the Judeo-Christian philosophy, but the two are welded. So I want people who would deal with the powers that be have some sense of what they believe. And so I thought, I want to tell this story in such a way that people who are not familiar with the story, as I was not when I started, will become much more familiar and be able to talk to people who do believe. And we'll be able to have a dialogue back and forth, because I think the terror in this nation, this is the most patriotic motive I ever had in my life, but the terror in this nation that we all feel is we are tearing apart. There's no conversation at all between the radical right and the left. And the center is occupied by both parties now. The Republicans are schizophrenic. On the one hand, they believe absolutely in Christ, no abortion, that they are pure Christians. On the other hand, they believe greed is good, gold is good, let's make fortunes, let's become that nation which is wealthiest of all nations, and the hell with the poor. And this is the Republican Party, totally schizophrenic. And between them, General Bill Clinton led the Democrats, so he occupies the middle between the two armies. It's a wonderful political situation. Couldn't be improved upon, it's so awful. So I thought, with all this, let's at least, since we're a Christian nation, we're always talking about it to the point where our ears ring with it, where most people, even half the people in America, hate the word Christian because they hear it so often. And it's always used manipulatively, or 9 times out of 10 it's used manipulatively. I thought, write a book that's a real novel, that's a story that people can live with.
I noticed, pardon me for attributing motive, but I noticed that a serious concern here is the question not of good and evil, but good in evil and evil in good.
That's always been my preoccupation.
Yes, and it seems to me that it's named immediately that, speaking of being a carpenter, Jesus says that the wood of the tree of knowledge, that the apple and the wood knew the difference between good and evil, and so the carpenters working with the wood to split the wood have difficulties because the wood too is incapable of not registering this distinction. Yep. And then throughout the subsequent book, and there is a wonderful, wonderful sentence there, Jesus says that nevertheless a bad man crossing under a good tree will cause the leaves to shiver.
Yeah, an evil man passing under a tree will sadden the leaves.
You will sadden the
sadden
leaves.
Its leaves, yeah.
and what follows throughout here is the knowledge that good and evil are going to be, in these messages as slanted by you, conjoined. That there's not going to be a simple purging of devils. That devils are built into the structure somehow.
Oh, you know, I would go further. I would say, you know, people would say, where does Mailer feel the right to take on this story? He can't pretend he's a man who's all good or good enough to understand Jesus. He may have to hope that he's only half evil and he's half good. How does such a man dare to presume? And my answer would be, first of all, that the basic notion of Jesus is that Jesus, which is to say goodness, is present in all of us. And if we have a little of it, then we're able to understand someone who has much more. Because at the moment we're good, we're very good. You see, there's no such thing as knowing, on those rare times we know it, that we've performed a good, a decent, a nice act without knowing how very good goodness is, because we have had this little taste of it. It's, for instance, if you get the taste of sugar for the first time in your life, you don't have to eat a lot of sugar to know what sugar is. The same is true of goodness. It's good. And so I just felt, I have that in me. Everyone has that in them. The most evil person in the world has that in them. I had the pleasure and difficulty of writing about Gary Gilmore for 2 years. He had goodness in him. We all have this goodness in ourselves.
And an evil that's enormous. Jesus says when he is speaking of having for a moment betrayed the poor, he says that that moment of betrayal, however brief, can be a very powerful moment.
Yes, he almost forgives Judas at that moment because, or in fact, indeed he does, in that he recognizes there's truth in what Judas is saying. If you move away from the poor by a little, you will move away from them by a lot. Why are they fighting? Because they agree.
But it does seem to me that this is the question going on in the Mailer version of the Testament, and not necessarily, in other words, those people who are saying that the book is not sufficiently different from...
Oh, it's very different. It's very different.
...are not recognizing that...
It's wearing the same suit as the New Testament, but the insides are awfully different. For example, there's nothing in the New Testament that suggests that evil, that Jesus has one iota of evil in him. Jesus worries. He shook hands with the devil up on the mountain when he was tempted. He shook hands because he was a little afraid not to shake hands with the devil. He was tempted to jump and despised himself in some part of himself for not jumping. He feels the presence of the devil in him to a small degree. Jesus, who is better than anyone else who has ever been on earth, still has a touch of evil in him, is the way I saw it. You simply cannot have unalloyed goodness. Now, this is beyond being heretical. It's simply one novelist's thoughts on the matter. There's nothing to do with the theology.
And there's very little unalloyed evil also.
Very little unalloyed evil, yes. The devil's not all evil. He's obviously got a man of some personal charm and distinction.
The moneylenders are not all evil.
No.
And in addition, this is a Jesus who is nearly constantly seeing what it is that God told Moses before him, and Isaiah and Ezekiel, that all of the other people who've been in this role of leader and prophet are seen as mentor figures.
Absolutely. Well, in that sense, Jesus is very much a traditionalist. He grew up with the Old Testament recounted to him orally, and he lives with it. He lives with the prophets. He uses them always. He's looking for either for sanction or for guidance by the acts and deeds and words of the prophets, which is one of the things I want to do with the book is bring in a great deal of the Old Testament, which I think is a much more beautiful book in the literary sense, and just bring it in to show what his tradition was. His tradition was nobler and not nobler, but was more poetic than his present condition. It, just as in America, people don't speak as well now, in America and in England, they used to speak 50 and 100 and 200 years ago. So the same was true in Palestine.
We're told very movingly in the He Who Is Without Sin chapter that Jesus comes from a tradition in which to pardon Mary Magdalene is a very grave thing to do.
Very grave.
This is if there is a set piece in the Mailer telling of the Jesus story, the Gospel according to the Son, it is that, where he is called upon almost as a test to reveal to the Pharisees what he will say about this woman taken in adultery. His refusal to look upon her face is exquisitely choreographed. He continues to write in the sand. He's very canny. He doesn't let people see what he's writing in the sand. Mm. And it is the attempt to buy time, it seems, until we will hear what he says. Now, this question about women is, of course, a question that has dogged Mailer, too, for most of his life and his writing. So how does Jesus respond?
To begin with, he's not only buying time, but out of the deep instinct he has of... about people's relation to their own morality, that he's immensely aware of how people are both moral and not moral, not immoral but not moral, and he knows that moral reactions come slowly. So one of the reasons, why is he, what is he buying time for? He's buying time in order for the shame to set in with these people who are ready to stone Mary Magdalene. So he waits. He waits, if you will, like a great actor, for that moment when he can say, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. All right, so then they start to go away, the oldest first, because they have the most sins. And finally, no one's left except Mary. He is still terrified to look at her because he grew up as an Essene, and their belief was intense that you had nothing to do with a woman unless you wished to make a child. And so there's an old saying in the Talmud that probably existed in prehistoric times even, that if you have an ugly temptation, not only build a fence around it, but build a fence around the fence. And so that's what he's doing. He's not looking at her. Finally, he emboldens himself enough to look at her. Now they're left alone, and she's as beautiful as he feared she would be. And what he sees in her is a Jezebel. He quotes from Jezebel about how Jezebel was destroyed, how horses rode over her and so forth and destroyed her. And at the same time, he looks at her and he thinks that in her beauty, he also sees God. And then he thinks that in the welter of her fornications, yes, even there when she's embracing the devil and men, God is also present in the act. And therefore, he can not judge her. He can avoid having to judge her. So he goes through this positive set of feelings toward her and reads from Ezekiel about how awful the punishments are for a whore and a wanton. And when he finishes, because in part of it, part of the punishment is the woman loses her nose, Mary Magdalene looks at him and says, I do not want to lose my nose. And that moves him, and he forgives her. He says, but the moment he forgives her, he feels her vanity again. And then he feels he must exorcise her because she is filled with demons. And so then the last part of the passage is that he exorcises her seven powers and demons.
I was terrifically moved in this chapter by the implicit interpretation of if thine eye offends thee, pluck it out, because this is one of those passages that there are enough interpretations of. But in this chapter, in this version by Mailer, it's very clear that what is being plucked out is the impulse to take offense at the woman.
Mm. That I hadn't put it to myself that way, but it's true.
Yeah.
Yes, he's trying to purify himself at that moment.
And saying, you know, whatever leads you to judge, lop it off. You'd better go into heaven with only one eye, with only one leg, with only one hand, than to remain offended.
You know, I realized something about that famous saying about, if thine hand offend thee, cut it off. I'd never realized it before until I wrote it. And, you know, that was the proscription against masturbation.
Yes.
If thy hand offend thee, cut it off. And there, all these young boys are looking at her. Oh, there's a girl who was caught in the act. They're picturing the act, and they're getting excited. And so he says, if thy hand offend thee, cut it off.
I hope here that, unlike other places that have presumed that this is a casual or, pardon me here, left-handed work, that one can hear that there is passion here, not just in the reading of the Lazarus section, but that a good deal of deliberation has gone into the making of this book. I wanted to ask the final question.
Before you do, may I say one
thing?
Yes. I should not write a left-handed work when I know I'm going to get hit with a lot of right hands.
When Gide writes his Bible stories, he's trying to bring to the biblical his sense that things should be intricate and clever. When Mann writes his Bible stories, there is the sense that he is trying to imagine the distinction between neighboring relating nations, tribes, going to war with one another over the figure of Joseph. That this is an early version of what will lead Mann to America, that the Bible is seen as predicting the division, say, of Europe. What is Mailer writing his Bible stories for?
I can't answer that. I don't know. You know, I work a lot out of instinct. sometimes, often you get happy results when you work out of instinct in connection with research. But this book I wrote very much out of instinct. Some people who are close to me at the beginning said, you're out of your mind to write this. It's the worst book you could possibly write. And it wasn't as if I had a religious calling. I didn't wake up. No angel anointed me. No angel came down and said, thou shalt write this book. No, it wasn't like that. It was almost as if the hurt pride of the novelist that I'm living in a dying profession said, write this book. Just show what novelists can do for once. You don't have to be a religious mystic. You don't have to be an expert of this sort or that sport. Novelists are their own kind of expert, which is they can explore into realms of human experience that no one else can. And they can do it very simply. And you don't have to have huge buildings housing immense equipment in order to do it.
No biblical spectaculars. I immediately, in fact, thought of the amount of time that Dwight MacDonald spent decrying the biblical spectaculars, and since they were the laughing stock of schlock culture in your time and in mine, were you afraid of ending up with something that would error on the side of the miraculous? I mean, the culture wants that horribly.
Well, I knew it wouldn't happen in the novel. If someday a movie is made of this book and everything goes wrong, the movie of The Naked of the Dead is one of the worst movies I ever saw in my life. So the one thing I know about movies is they can go badly wrong, very badly wrong. Sure, this could end up as a piece of schlock, the miracles. You could have violence playing while the miracles take place. Anything can end up as a piece of schlock if you have people who are, on the one hand, greedy enough, and the other hand, insensitive enough to be driving the money machine at full speed across the desert, yes? The cultural desert, yes?
But you were confident in your own ability to avoid schlock, bad taste, junky response to the culture. You felt at this point without illusions.
I certainly wasn't worried about that. It didn't occur to me. This could be a silly vanity, but it just didn't occur to me that I could write a schlocky book. If a man's been making shoes for 50 years and he's gotten very, very good at it, he doesn't go in one morning and say, gee, I don't know, maybe I'll make a lousy pair of shoes today.
I've been speaking to Norman Mailer. The occasion, The Gospel According to the Sun, published by Random House. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, Michael, once again, thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bus.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.